Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 25th, 2012. Happy Memorial Weekend, everyone. On this weekend, lots of us will gather for hot dogs and hamburgers and beer. But of course, it's about much more than backyard barbecues. It's about military service and sacrifice. So we're spending a little time with the military today and learning about how Marines at Camp Pendleton are themselves learning financial literacy.
If you are financially stable, that means that, okay, that aspect of your life is squared away. There's less things detracting you from your mission in the squadron.
And we'll also hear from military spouses about the financial challenges they face as husbands and wives deploy to war.
Making sure our powers of attorney were in order, making sure life insurance was in order. You have those unpleasant conversations as kind of a habit.
And perspective from one of the country's 5 million long-term unemployed as she struggles to break out of that cycle. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau launched another attack on the forces of financial darkness this week. It announced plans to regulate prepaid credit cards. Now, those cards are increasingly popular despite the fact that they have all kinds of hidden fees and they're pretty much not liable for fraud. I've asked Stacey Vanek-Smith of our New York Bureau to fill us in here. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Tess.
So, you know, when I think of these cards, I think of kind of a financial netherworld. You know, they're traditionally used by a pretty small sector of the public, kind of like the check cashing services that are out there,
right,
things like that. So why are regulators paying attention now?
Well, the cards have become a lot more mainstream. It's actually the fastest growing form of payment in the country right now. There are about 7 million prepaid cards out there. And by 2014, people will have loaded $167 billion onto those cards.
Woo.
So, yeah, they used to be very much a fringe product geared towards low income people and people who had really bad credit and couldn't get a checking account. But that's just not the case anymore.
So why are people using them more and who's using them?
Well, a lot of younger people are using them, actually, for Generation Y. Half of Gen Yers have these cards. Basically, these are people who grew up during the financial crisis. They don't have a lot of credit, but they also don't have a very good impression of the banks. And this is sort of seen as a responsible way. You just load up your card and you spend the money you have. There's no overdraft. There are no checking fees. They're not trying to push other products on you. It's just this card. A lot of parents give it to their kids when they go off to college. So this has created a big opportunity for the banks. It's an entire new market for them.
So what exactly is the CFPB doing?
Well, the CFPB is just looking into these cards to regulate them because they are becoming more mainstream. And there are suddenly a lot of big players, like Chase is releasing its liquid prepaid debit card this summer. Susie Orman, you know, has a prepaid debit card. Suddenly you have this financial product that is sort of wildly different. So there's not a lot of regulation in this field now. It's a little bit like the Wild West. The fees for customers aren't really regulated. And actually, another thing that the banks are very excited about is interchange fees. You know, the fees that banks charge the merchants when you swipe your card.
Right.
Those are regulated now for debit and credit cards, but they're not regulated for prepaid debit cards. So regulators are starting to sort of look into this and figure out kind of what's going on and curb some of the tales of abuse that one hears.
Okay. Before we leave the subject of credit cards, I wanted to get your take on something that I saw this week, which is that American Express has issued a new card where the rewards are available in Farmville online. So your rewards are not real. What?
Yes. Well, I guess it depends how into Farmville you are, right?
I suppose so.
I mean, this is an example of, you know, credit cards are really right now trying to offer different kinds of rewards to attract new users now.
Right.
Rewards are very targeted. I assume that they are trying to target a younger audience through offering virtual points on Farmville, which is, of course, the Facebook game where you raise virtual crops and animals.
Right.
And so I think this is also perhaps another way of kind of luring in younger consumers who might see that, as strange as that might sound to us. That's maybe their frequent flyer miles, you know?
All right. Hey, thanks for the update, Stacey.
Thank you, Tess.
So a few days ago when we were sitting around the newsroom talking about the Facebook IPO, ad nauseum, by the way, someone wondered aloud whether people might be trying to buy shares for their kids. Yeah, said one of our producers, a gateway stock. Clever. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to outline the gains and losses of doing so.
Here's why you might consider buying a share of stock for a child.
When I was around 8 years old, my grandpa was always listening to NPR when we were in the car, and I would hear the market updates, and I never understood what it meant. It just sounded like gibberish.
Sasha Burnett is 26 years old now. When she was a kid, she says her grandpa bought her shares of Disney to help her understand the stock market.
We would open up the newspaper, find the Disney stock, and take a look and see, okay, did it go down? Did it go up? And he would ask me questions about it. Do you think it's doing well? Do you think we should keep our shares? Should we cash them out?
Once upon a time, giving the gift of stock was common. That's how Jason Alderman was introduced to the concept.
I first got my share of General Motors when I was 10 years old for my 10-year-old birthday. And back then, they issued an actual beautiful-looking paper share. That did feel very real to me, and I really did appreciate that.
Now, Alderman is Senior Director of Financial Education at Visa. He recommends parents consider using a share of stock as a teaching tool.
When you own something, you treat it and interact with it very differently. And so having a child who is able to own a share of a stock is much more real than just learning about it from a school book.
He practices what he preaches with his own family. When Visa went public, his 8-year-old son Daniel wanted his own piece of the company. But who should pay for it?
We went back and forth, my wife and I, about whether we should buy that share for him or whether he should use his own money that he had made from lemonade stand sales and from allowances to purchase the share. And in the end, we decided that it made a lot more sense to have him use his own money for it. He had a much stronger sense of ownership of it. It wasn't just free monopoly money that we were giving him. It was his money.
Using the money from his piggy bank, Daniel bought one share of Visa for $44. He held it through some ups and downs and finally sold it a couple of years later for $110. And it was the child's decision.
Help them understand the pros and cons and help them understand the choices and let them make the choices. It may not be the choice that you would make, but having them make that choice, and even if they realize it's ultimately the wrong choice, is still a very valuable lesson.
But not everyone agrees that a stock is appropriate for a child.
7 and 8-year-olds are not old enough or sophisticated enough to begin to understand the economics.
Walter Dold teaches finance at the University of Connecticut.
The danger is, one, it might lead kids to think that it's a casino or a video game. Or secondly, it might get them overly involved with being wealthy.
As a child, Sasha Burnett turned a profit on her Disney stock. Did it go to her head? Did she become a rich Wall Street buccaneer?
I wish I could report that, but no, it was a fun experiment to do with my grandpa, but it's not something that I've gone back to as an individual myself.
If you decide to buy a share for a kid, you could buy it through a broker, or you could get an old-fashioned stock certificate. Lance Lee is CEO of a company called OneShare.com. He says sometimes the paper certificate becomes worth more than the stock itself.
We have seen instances where the stock certificate is actually worth many times more than the stock ever was.
That's especially true for companies that went bust. Collectors covet the stock certificates for Wall Street's greatest losers. Think Enron or eToys. Lee says that the value of the stock certificate for Webvan appreciated as the share price fell.
And by the time they went bankrupt, we've seen the certificate go as high as $200.
Lee says companies keep hinting that they're going to phase out paper stock certificates. Of course, that would only make the existing ones more valuable, providing one more teachable moment for a kid, a lesson in supply and demand. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And joining me now, as he does every once in a while, our senior producer, Patty Hirsch. Hi, Patty.
Hello, Tess.
So I guess a lot of people want to
So I guess a lot of people would have wanted to buy Facebook stock as a gateway investment over these last few days.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of them, I think, would probably have wanted to do the Disney thing where they get like the stock certificates
right.
and their child can frame it and all the rest of it. But if they did that, they're going to be sorely disappointed because Facebook actually isn't going to issue paper stock certificates. So there's nothing to frame. All you're going to get is like a paper printout of your transaction.
Hmm.
This seems to be the way that companies are going these days. Tech companies, certainly. Apple stopped issuing paper certificates in 2010, for example.
Well, speaking of paper, I hear we have a lot of letters this week.
Yeah, lots of comments on our student debt roundtable.
Oh, yeah. A couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. But first, from last week's show, John Mitchell of Ferrisburg, Vermont, wrote in. He was a bit upset by the advice that Jill Schlesinger gave our organic farmer caller.
Hmm.
Yeah, I remember he called in asking how to spend or invest his savings, rather, in a non-risky way. And Jill directed him towards a tax-deferred college savings plan and some laddered CDs.
What, John didn't think that was a good idea?
Well, not that that was a bad idea, but he said we should have advised the caller to set up an emergency fund first. The way I think we were thinking about it was that he already really had an emergency fund. It was that $150,000
right.
in a money market account. It was precisely that.
So what did listeners have to say about that roundtable? We talked to Robert Reich and Neil McCluskey. And I thought it was a great conversation.
Yeah, I mean, listeners had a lot to say. Firstly, to Matt Stride of St. Paul. You may remember that we topped that round table with some comments from people who are carrying kind of large debt loads of student debt.
Not kind of, really large.
Really large, yeah. We actually recorded Matt talking about his student debt load, but he didn't make it onto the show because the phone line that he was on was very crackly.
Mm.
But he was kind of miffed because he said we only had sob stories about people who have these large debt loads on the show. And he says that his family has $10,000 in student debt, and they're doing just fine.
Good for him.
Indeed. He's a lucky guy, I think.
Yes.
Not sure quite how he's managing it, but I'd like to hear. Tyler Buett wrote in from Indianapolis to say that he thinks that university financial offices aren't much help when it comes to handling debt.
Mm.
So here's a quote. Ultimately, it's up to the students to take control of their decisions, but it should also be up to the universities to provide upfront, honest, and transparent information.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that the universities have come in for quite a bit of criticism.
And rightly so, I think, in some cases. Mark Sullivan echoed that in a post on our website. He wrote in that, like all major events in personal finance, paying for college takes planning.
Hmm.
The problem is that most Americans arrive at college with no plan, and as a result, they take the financial aid office's default plan, which is taking on debt.
Right.
Right. He was actually a bit upset that Reich and McCluskey came from either side of the political spectrum and didn't really give any specific advice. But the idea was really to have a more philosophical debate over things like McCluskey's contention that you should be able to pay for your dream degree, otherwise it's not worth doing it.
Mm.
Ed Woodjack didn't like the sound of that. He wrote in to say that some degrees pay for themselves, but others, like philosophy degrees, for example, do not. But he says the world is a better place with philosophers in it, so maybe we should pay people to do philosophy degrees.
Whoa, well, that's a first. I don't think I've heard that one before.
Well, it's certainly a response.
I'm guessing we might get some letters on that.
We could. I hope we do.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in, Patty.
And thanks for having me. And thank you once again to the listeners. Please keep those letters coming.
On this Memorial Weekend, we're going to take some time to talk about the military. We actually get quite a bit of mail from service members and their families, giving us a glimpse into some of the financial issues they face that the rest of us don't. Several months back, we got an email from Lieutenant Colonel Wade Hassel. He's commanding officer for the Marine Light Attack Helicopter Squadron 367. They're stationed at Camp Pendleton, just north of San Diego. A couple of years back, he heard a story we did about the U.S. Navy's financial readiness program. I thought that was a great idea, he wrote. So he came up with his own program for his Marines. And we decided that was worth a trip to the base. The HMLA 367 Squadron, a.k.a. Scarface, has served multiple tours of duty in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But while they're back stateside, on base, it is drill after drill after drill as pilots practice takeoffs and landings.
Just get a quick walk around to the bird, make sure everything's finalized and buttoned up, nothing's hanging off.
These are multi-million dollar aircraft with complex machinery used in battle, and the last thing Hassel can afford is a distracted pilot.
If you are financially stable, that means that, okay, that aspect of your life is squared away. There's less things detracting you from your mission in the squadron. Anything that keeps you focused on your job of fixing, flying, maintaining aircraft is what we want.
I don't know if any of you have received this class already from your division financial representatives.
So the commanding officer requires his entire squadron to learn the basics of finance.
My name's Captain John R. Stange with the United States Marine Corps.
Captain Stange is one of the officers Hassell recruited to teach younger, newer Marines how to manage their finances. Their makeshift classroom was actually a locker room attached to the helicopter hangar.
So we're starting with your basic pay, pay and allowances. Okay, we have two types of pay. We have our basic pay, our base pay, and then we have special pay. Which
Stange talked a group of a dozen or so squad members through the military's somewhat Byzantine pay structure. Other topics have included everything from car loans to saving for retirement from active duty. All of this because of concerns Hassell had for his Marines in the wake of the financial crisis.
When the market crashed in late 09, I was having a discussion with the commanding officer, and I was saying, you know, the Marine Corps, when I was brought up through it, I've been in 24 years now, I'd never really had anyone sit down and explain certain fundamentals of financial readiness to me. And somewhere in that conversation, either I volunteered or he voluntold me, why don't we get a class going?
Money is not a subject that pretty much anybody wants or likes to talk about. The military is, shall we say it, not a touchy-feely place. How do you get people to talk about money here when civilians won't even talk about it?
And it's not that we want them to necessarily talk about their particular situation. It's that we want to make sure that they have the opportunities to either improve upon their situation or fix a bad one. We need to know if someone's in financial troubles because that can affect our operational readiness. The other aspect of military service is if you declare bankruptcy or something along those lines, you could lose your security clearance. So it is a fine line that we tread because in this process here, we can't necessarily recommend, say, credit unions over banks because that gets us into trouble, but we can show them the difference and the strengths and the pros and cons of a bank and a credit union. Those types of things so that Marine and their spouse can make an informed decision.
Five, four, three, two, one, hack. At my hack, the time was 16:43. Roll call, Captain Lott and crew. Your event number 7102, TAC 1 Bravo.
In addition to their regular military duties, several members of HMLA 367 serve as command financial specialists. They're the ones who teach the classes and provide any financial counseling that squad members might ask for. Staff Sergeant Luke Schemenauer is one of them.
The biggest problems that I get when Marines come into my office, a lot of the Marines don't even understand all their pay, and they don't look at their leave and earnings statement to actually see how much money's coming in. They can't keep track of their spending. Also, some don't even have access to their bank accounts. Their parents have control of it, and a lot of them get creditors calling the command, and they don't know how to handle that.
Captain A.J. Ferrone is another command financial specialist. He also just happens to have a degree in economics.
I think you brought up the question before of how do you discuss this out in the open with your Marines? And, you know, obviously you can't order them to talk about it, but, you know, you can kind of gather up the shop and say, all right, guys, you know, Friday afternoon, what do you want to talk about? You're thinking about buying a car. You know, how's that going to work into your budget? And then you get that response of what budget? So you can kind of gauge, you know, okay, I kind of see where we're starting out with now. This is a budget. This is why debt's bad. And you can kind of go through some of these basic tenets.
And to that end, Hassell and his finance team have made it just about as easy as possible for their Marines to learn basic money lessons. Those lessons come in the form of something called a stall wall, an 8x11 sheet of paper filled with all kinds of fun facts about money management.
And we put them in the stalls of the bathrooms.
Well, of course they do.
So when a Marine is going about their business, they get to, you know, have something to read. So we will put up once a week a stall wall talking about some sort of finance aspect. But before we put it up, the Marines have a discussion within their division about that week's topic. So say we're going to discuss opportunity cost or dollar cost averaging. So they get a little 5-minute blurb before they go home for the weekend on it. And then it sits up on the wall. and they can read about it in a little bit greater detail as time goes on. This is Lance Corporal Brown, one of our maintainers. This is Tess Biglin.
Out in the hangar, on a tour of the squadron's Super Cobra, Viper, and Venom helicopters, it's easy to see why Hassel wants his people focused amid the complex machinery.
What are you working on today?
Doing a daily, sir.
Okay. Bird going on the flight schedule later on?
Not today, sir.
Okay.
Post things.
Okay. So here's the hangar. This is a Whiskey Cobra that we have going through phase maintenance right now. Step up. So this is the back seat of the Whiskey cockpit. You can see all what we call the steam gauges. So
you look at something this complicated, and it's obvious that you don't want anything distracting.
Exactly. When you get in here and you're flying on low light level and you're wearing night vision goggles and you have to fly low through terrain, operating something like this takes a lot of effort. And financial readiness might be one of those little extra steps that keeps our pilots from doing something bad with the aircraft, and it keeps our maintainers focused on doing what they need to do.
Most of this advice is targeted at getting Marines financially fit before they ever deploy. But Hassel says what the military is dealing with now are Marines coming back stateside with what he says is something akin to financial PTSD.
There can be issues, and for me personally, it was, I do have friends that coming back, you know, they didn't have to pay for anything while they're deployed. The chow was free, you know, not necessarily good, but it was free. The only thing I paid for on my deployments was really a haircut. So I spent $5 a week. That was it. When you do come back, I've heard people tell stories related to post-traumatic stress disorder. That's part of the problem, coming back and now having to deal with a different type of reality to them that is less. It's like, why am I concerned about this bill when just a couple weeks ago I was concerned about my buddy? A homeowner's fee doesn't make sense to me. And just getting back into that rigmarole of you got to pay, you know, it's the first of the month. Oh, shoot, I forgot to put out the trash and I forgot to pay my bills.
I know this is a brand new program, but would you like to at some point see this kind of effort mandatory as part of training?
As a commander, commanders don't necessarily like mandatory things. Commanders like to command. If this works out, and I expect that we will learn something and the program will be modified, it'll be maintained. And then I think the best way for this is through ownership, as Marines go to other units and they spread it that way. You know, there are tons of courses that the military has out there that people can go get counseling. I've just never seen anything on a unit level.
That yellow line. Yeah, it's too quiet.
You really have to see some examples of those stall walls. Might even want to copy the idea at home. So we've got them at marketplace.org. You can also see photos from our trip to Camp Pendleton. And if you're in the military and looking for more resources, we have some links from the Department of Defense. And stay tuned a bit later in the show when we'll be talking with three military spouses stationed at Vandenberg Air Force Base about how they deal with the vagaries of managing money in the military. One of the stall walls we saw at Camp Pendleton was about budgeting. It had a list of 10 of the biggest money drains on your wallet. So the military is all for frugality and proud of it. But that doesn't seem to be the case with all penny pinchers. I mean, we call them penny pinchers, right? Well, Meg Favreau, senior editor of wisebread.com, is here to set us all straight. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Tess.
I wanted to talk to you about something that you had sent to us where you said, let's stop apologizing for frugal living. Who's apologizing?
People who are living frugally.
Why are they doing that?
So I am the senior editor of Wise Bread. It's a frugal living publication.
Exactly.
And one thing that I see a lot is writers writing from this place of, hey, having a board game night isn't maybe as fun as going out to a bar, but you'll learn to like it. And it's just like, that's the worst sales pitch ever.
It is, actually.
It's awful. Here's the problem with that. Too often, frugal living is pitched as a necessity, a thing that you do where you're wanting for stuff
mm-hmm.
and you can't have the lifestyle that you want, but hey, you're financially okay, so isn't that better? And, well, A, yes, it is
right.
very good to be financially okay, but frugal living isn't about wanting things.
Hmm.
It's about getting what you want. It's about prioritizing so that the things that are really important to you, you get to spend your money on those things. You get to spend your time on those mm-hmm. things, and you're frugal elsewhere so that you can do that.
Where do you think this comes from, this notion that you kind of have to back into the idea of frugality?
I think that people are so used to a certain lifestyle mm-hmm. and a lifestyle of excess. And I think often also because frugal living will come out of necessity. You know, your work situation changes, you're in a lot of debt. It's pitched as such a, like, necessity thing that people don't think of it as this much greater tool.
Hmm.
One thing that I like to tell people to do is a little activity where you write two lists down.
Okay.
And the first list is a list of goals of the things that you want to do in life.
Hmm.
And the second list is a list of things that you currently do that you think maybe you could cut back on. You don't necessarily know how. You don't even need to want to cut back on those things. But if you can, put them on the list.
Hmm.
And then you pick one thing from the list of things you really want to do and one thing from the list of things you can cut back on. And you start working toward both of those.
Hmm.
Those can be things that cost money, like travel or dining out more.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be things like spending more time with your family or things like that.
This actually reminds me of a conversation that we had on the show several weeks ago with Charles Duhigg, who wrote a book about habits.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that one of the most effective things that you can do is make sure that you have a reward waiting for you when you're trying to change a habit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are spending too much and you want to become a better saver, then the good thing is to have a reward out there for yourself, you know, at some point down the line. It sounds kind of similar to
yes,
what you're saying.
Yeah, here. No, I definitely agree with that. But it's even shifting perception even more. So it's not just like you're rewarding yourself mm-hmm. for a good habit. It's that good habit gets you this thing that you really want in life.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's almost like the ultimate reward.
Right, right. So it's big.
Yeah.
It's really big.
It's big. It's starting your own business. It's traveling the world for a few months. It's those sort of big life goals that you can achieve through frugal living.
You know, I think one of the things that might stop someone from actually being able to start a more frugal lifestyle is it's just plain hard. Again, it's all about habits, right?
Right.
So you should probably expect that it's not going to be easy.
Yes. Any big life change is going to be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing is to ease into it, to start small. For example, if you haven't exercised for
years
and you go and you join CrossFit and attempt to start a extremely difficult CrossFit regimen, I'm not saying that you won't stick with it, but I'm saying that it's probably more likely that if you just start walking
right.
and move up from there, you'll stick with it. You don't want frugal living to be painful. It won't always be easy, but the thing is to figure out what in your life makes it worth it and then work for that thing and to not apologize for it.
Meg Favreau, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Tess.
Speaking of frugality, what's more frugal than a yard sale? Well, now that summer is upon us, you might be tempted to turn your junk into easy money. But commentator Christina Wong warns us it's not that simple.
Perhaps you've seen shows like Storage Wars, where smack-talking working-class guys buy up abandoned storage units and unearth junk that's supposedly worth thousands of dollars. It's enough to get penny-pinching Americans thinking, wow, I'm going to get rich having a yard sale. But before you start scanning the weather for that perfect window of sunny days, indulge me in a little cost-benefit analysis. Sure, a weekend of lounging in your carport, sitting on a busted lawn chair looking quaintly ironic in that cheap giveaway visor you pulled straight from your sale, stuffing a fanny pack with $1 bills, sounds romantic. But placing ads, hammering up signs, hauling crap out to the yard, and let's face it, packing it back up again is at least a half day's work. Take into account having to divide your profits among the family and friends who help man your sale, and you'll probably fare better if everyone worked a day flipping burgers. And there aren't a lot of statistics on rummage sale-related heat strokes. But believe me, yard sales are a silent killer. Dehydrated in the sun since 5 a.m., haggling over a nickel for a threadbare ShamWow? No fun. Then there's the whole matter of throwing out your back, dragging that IKEA bookshelf down three flights of stairs, only to witness it disintegrate before your eyes. And I can't tell you how many families I've seen torn apart during a yard sale because a beloved hungry hippo game was accidentally sold off for a quarter. And is that extra cash worth the humiliation of letting your neighbors see your sizable collection of self-help books and Buns of Steel VHS tapes? My advice? Handpick your most valuable items, sell them on Craigslist, donate the rest, and enjoy the weekend with family and friends. Because when you come down to it, yard sales are a social event more than a moneymaker. They're for hoarders like me who need one last ritual of separation with our junk. A chance to redistribute our past lives among neighbors, only to buy them back the following year at their yard sale.
Christina Wong is a writer and performer here in Los Angeles. Earlier, we heard how a helicopter squadron at Camp Pendleton is teaching Marines about money management. In a military family, one of the biggest financial challenges is when a spouse deploys. We recently gathered a group of military spouses at Vandenberg Air Force Base in Lompoc, California, to talk about some of those challenges. Margot Kwasniewski's husband, Michael, has been in the Air Force for 15 years and is currently deployed. Ryan Filowich's wife, Amanda, has been in the military for 8 years. And Tamer Luck's husband, Aaron, is in the Army but stationed at Vandenberg. I started by asking Luck to talk about some of the issues that come up when her husband goes overseas.
I would say really for Aaron and I in the beginning, when he first deployed in 2003, we owned a home in Tennessee. So we sort of sat down and said, okay, this is the extra money that we're going to be getting because I'm going into combat zone. I'm a combat infantry officer, so I'll get that pay. What do we want to do with it? And we really felt that we should put it back towards into the house.
Mm-hmm.
But we also decided to set up a thrift savings plan, and he did that sort of on his end in Iraq, so like a retirement plan type thing. And the thrift savings plan has continued since 2003, so mm-hmm. it's something that happens. We don't really even know that it's going on and money comes out. So it's just
right. Well, that's the best way to do it, right?
Yeah.
You don't feel the pain.
Yeah. You know, it's never enough when they're going out to war anyway, if something should happen. But yes, tax-free and the extra income for combat pay is what they got. So
yeah. Ryan, your wife Amanda is not currently deployed, but what are some of the things that you have to deal with that other households probably don't? The discussions that you have to have purely because you're a military family?
One of the big financial burdens for us is moving a lot. Every time we move, there's always added expenses that we are not fully reimbursed for.
Yeah.
We also, you know, have to decide if we're going to buy a house, live on base, or rent somewhere.
And how did you make that decision whether you were going to buy a house or rent or live on base?
What we've done is looked at the market, looked at how much we were going to receive at our housing allowance. We've moved to California twice, and both times we decided to live on base just because of the cost of living here is very high. We did move to Minot, North Dakota before the big oil boom there, so the cost of living was fairly low, and it was a good time to invest in a house, and it worked out very well for us there.
Yeah. Margot, you and Michael are dealing with this right now. He's deployed. What financial issues are you facing that maybe you hadn't thought about, and were there some tough conversations to be had before he left?
Yes, I think there are always
is in a marriage, but I think with a military marriage, you just happen to have those conversations a little more often. So, yes, making sure our powers of attorney were in order, making sure life insurance was in order. You have those unpleasant conversations as kind of a habit. One of the things that we dealt with was the military savings plan, where you can save up to $10,000 and you get a guaranteed 10%, and they are able to do that when they deploy. Hmm. So each deployment, we have decided, okay, do we take that from a savings? Do we take that from investments? Do we, you know, is it worth it based on what the current market is doing in our particular fund and so forth? So we've made those kind of decisions. Also, to Tamer's point, doing thrift savings plans, if there is extra money with the tax exemption and any type of combat pay or dislocation allowances, all those types of financial benefits when somebody is deployed, what do you do with that?
Yeah. I think it was Ryan who touched earlier on one of the really touchy conversations that you have to have, which is that if you are a military spouse, one thing that you're faced with is the possibility that your spouse will not come home from a deployment. Now, obviously, you know, any couple, you have the possibility that someone won't be coming home. But what kinds of issues do you particularly have to face, and how much does the military really suggest to you that this is the kind of business that you've got to take care of, you know, powers of attorney, wills, all that sort of thing?
For all of us, it just becomes part of our lives. And, you know, I was also a police officer, so that added extra risk. And it's just always something that we talked about, you know, if something happens to us, you know, who's going to take care of the children, and just becomes part of your reality.
Yeah, right. One of the things this is Margo. One of the things that I wanted to add on to that was Ryan and I were talking before the discussion about with the moves, spouses having to make the decision to leave their jobs and leave careers and what that does to you financially. I know that he and I both had situations like that. One of our moves, I couldn't continue with my job anymore, and it more than cut our income by 50%. It was a very challenging to adjust to the lifestyle and adjust to the things that you need to change. So one of the things that we did when we first got married is we obtained life insurance. And that's one of the things that we knew to get early on. You think if something were to happen, you want to make sure that it's more than just what the military would allot, because it would take a whole lot more to get your life back on track.
Yeah, and Ryan, you decided not to continue your career as a police officer?
It was quite a shock at first, going from, you know, I worked patrol as a police officer and was also on the SWAT team, to staying at home, changing diapers all day. It was a big difference.
Yeah. And income-wise?
Income-wise, yes, big difference. We quickly realized that there was a lot less expendable cash around. So it was making decisions of what do you want and what do you need.
I wonder, is money management something that you talk about when you get together for coffee or dinner or whatever as military spouses? Or is that so private that it just doesn't come up? As is the case in most of the civilian world where nobody talks about it. Is it any different in your world?
This is Margo. I think it depended a lot on the relationship, and that's probably true of military and civilian. Like a friend of mine, her husband was deployed before my husband was deployed. She was my neighbor, and she said, oh, we're buying a vehicle through this program that you can get a vehicle, and they cut the price, and they do things with the taxing and titling a little bit different when your spouse is deployed. I didn't know about that program. So I thought, that's great information. So it became a little bit more sharing good info.
Ryan, what's the experience been like for you?
I think with all the deployments and moves and the hardships that we all face, we really come together as a community, and, you know, everybody's always bouncing ideas and tips off of everybody, because every base you're at, stuff's a little different and you learn different things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot, too, with social media now, where you can find a lot of information that way.
Tamer, what do you think? Are finances something that are a topic of discussion or not?
No, actually, I think very much so. I think the other thing is that we all know what everybody makes.
Right.
Ah.
When my husband was a captain and he was deployed, and I was the family readiness group leader, sort of taking those spouses under my wing and teaching them, saying, hey, there are resources out here, like what Margot was sharing, is that the finance department, it's free services to us. Hmm. We can go into the financial department and say, hey, can you help me with a budget? We want to buy a new car, or we want to buy a home or something, you know, and showing them that there's free services out there. And I think, you know, we don't get that. People don't get that in the civilian world. They have to pay for those services.
Right.
I think it is something that we do talk about.
That brings up, I think, also an issue of money management within the household. And, you know, I think prior to maybe 10, 15 years ago, before the onset of online banking, there was a much bigger issue with spouses at home really having to completely take over and manage the entire budget for the household. But now I wonder, is it more of a partnership now, or is it still kind of on the home front, you're really taking care of things?
In our household, I pretty much take care of all the day-to-day stuff. Whenever we make a big purchase or something, you know, then we're bouncing the budget around together and finding where stuff fits with all the online banking and everything now. And moving, you know, we keep banks at different places, and we always need to remind each other if something does happen to one of us, you know, these are the accounts that we have, and to try to remember to take care of everything and passwords and everything.
How about you, Tamer?
I definitely took over the finances right after we got married. He knows that I've got the finances, got it covered, all the bills are paid, and with the online banking now and everything that you can do electronically, that is the most beautiful thing that anybody ever created, because it makes my life not as stressful.
Right.
Again, it sounds to me like you all have learned all the lessons that just about every household needs to learn.
Right.
I think most militaries... families are a little more mature than most people, because we have to have all this stuff organized and ready to go all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today to talk about what it's like to live a financial life in the military. And please pass along our thanks to your spouses for their service. Tamer Luck, Ryan Filowich, and Margot Kwasniewski have been joining us from Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California. Thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've got links to all sorts of resources for military families at marketplace.org. $5 million. That's how many Americans have been out of work for 6 months or more. We don't hear much about the long-term unemployed. Well, we hear numbers, but we don't often hear directly from them because many give up looking for work and the government stops counting them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer spoke with one woman who refuses not to be counted.
Leslie Perkins has a sparkling smile and infectious laugh. She's single, in her early 40s. I met her at her condo in Northern Virginia.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Nancy.
I'm Nancy.
Come on in.
The walls are painted bright yellow. A pet bunny named Daisy dozes in a cage in one corner. We settle onto the couch. Perkins lost her job about 18 months ago, 2 weeks after her mom died. She took a week off to bury her mother, then...
went back to work and was let go. Yeah, it was very, very tough.
And things haven't gotten any easier. Perkins has a morning routine. She feeds Daisy, then calls her father to check up on him. He's also sick, diagnosed with a rare gastrointestinal disease in 2008. Next, Perkins settles down in front of her computer to see if she's had any bites.
Check my Yahoo account just to see if anybody has responded. Let's see. I have 3 emails, and they are junk emails. So, yeah.
Perkins estimates she's sent out hundreds of resumes in the past 18 months. In all that time, she's had just 6 interviews, and some of them were over the phone. Her resume is impressive. She has a PhD in organizational psychology. Her last job was as a management consultant. Perkins says now her job is seen as a luxury by companies obsessed with surviving in a rough economy.
Unfortunately, I think that in the short term, it's a matter of stopping the bleeding right away rather than having necessarily a long-term view.
But Perkins has to stop the bleeding on her balance sheet. She has a monthly mortgage for her condo. Her unemployment checks will stop coming in a few months. Her COBRA health insurance ends in a few days. She's managed to find a new bare-bones insurance plan for herself, and she's got some savings. She canceled her cable, avoids the mall, and never goes out to eat. Still, she knows her money will run out eventually if she doesn't get a job. Perkins says it's hard not to get depressed.
I think you definitely feel low, and it would be hard not to feel low in this situation. Every time I get a rejection letter, it's like, oh my gosh, what is wrong? But it's kind of like, okay, let me kind of get over this.
But some people never get over the rejection and the trauma of losing a job. Suicides increase during a recession, and the longer you're unemployed, the higher the risk you'll attempt suicide. Richard Dunn is a health economist at Texas A&M University. Dunn has studied what happens to workers who lose their jobs in mass layoffs.
There's an additional suicide for every 4,000 to 7,000 jobs that are lost, which doesn't sound like a lot until you consider that in the last year, there were nearly 2 million job losses from mass layoffs.
Dunn says the downward spiral toward suicide starts with withdrawal. People stop meeting up with friends and avoid neighbors. They don't want to talk about the loss of their job or much of anything. Back in Northern Virginia, Leslie Perkins says she does have to fight the temptation to withdraw into a shell.
Yeah, I mean, I could sit around being mad and frustrated and bitter. And in the end, the only one that hurts is myself. And so I'm not in the business of trying to hurt myself. I experience all those things, but okay, been there, done that, let's move on. What's the next step?
Perkins already has the answer for that. She rifles through a clear plastic box crammed with manila folders. She calls it her current projects box.
So it has my resumes, it has all the stuff that I've worked on. I'm working on at the moment.
One thing Perkins is working on at the moment, a support group for the unemployed called the Job Seekers Accountability Group. Perkins started the group about a month ago. She gives group members assignments every week.
And I really hesitate to call it homework, but in some way it's homework. And then we also have what I call a challenge of the week, things that we really need to do to kind of get ourselves out there and visible.
But Perkins says it's hard to make yourself visible to prospective employers.
There's the throwing your resume out there and just hoping it sticks. And there's kind of the, okay, let me take a more strategic, targeted approach to doing this. Probably I've gotten to that point.
So she researches companies before applying for a job with them. She puts keywords in her resume that she thinks computer programs will search for, and she tries to get to the people doing the hiring. Perkins is telling me about her network of friends and former colleagues who give her tips on job openings when her cell phone rings.
See, that actually might be a potential project.
Oh, pick it up.
No, well, hello? Hi, Janie, how are you doing?
Janie is a colleague of Perkins's former boss. She thinks Perkins would be the perfect person to run an employee survey for a client of hers. It would be a freelance project, not a full-time job, but it's a start. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Hawaii. That is the new home of the Marine Light Attack Helicopter Squadron 367. Yes, the entire unit is off to the islands. The Marines ship out from Camp Pendleton in just a few weeks. They'll be bringing the Stalwall with them, of course. And that great financial literacy idea wins them a piggy this week. So, Scarface, look after your pig. Keep him off the poo-poo platter. Feed him well, and he will be Semper Fidelis. Boing, boing. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, the cost of making dreams come true.
We sold everything off and moved into a trailer and started on our road. We call it our Daniel Boone era. We had no sewer or water to the trailer and no electricity.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your long weekend. This is APM.